This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, it took him a year, but today President Obama finally explained exactly what he wants in a health care bill. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 22nd of February, and it is great to have you here. We have heard from the White House on health care today. The president's going to have to sign that bill if and when it happens. He put his plan out on the internet this morning, 3 days before a big televised summit with the House and Senate. Obviously, there's a lot in there. One key part of it would let the federal government block or roll back some what are called excessive increases in premiums. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer how those premiums are set in the first place.
It sounds simple enough.
Total premiums have to be adequate to cover claims and expenses.
That's Corey Uccello. She's an actuary at the American Academy of Actuaries. Actuaries at health insurance companies crunch the numbers to come up with premiums. She says the first rule is set premiums high enough to cover your costs. You can follow a sort of blueprint looking at a person's age and health.
So a 55-year-old man, for example, who has a history of health problems is going to be expected to have higher health spending than, say, a younger and healthy 25-year-old.
Then you factor in rising hospital costs and doctor's fees. Sounds simple again, but it gets complicated. Insurance companies have overhead costs, marketing, payroll, lobbying. All that gets rolled into premiums, and insurers are regulated by the states, and each state's regulations are different. Jerry Katz is a healthcare analyst at Kurt Salmon Associates.
It's variable state to state how much oversight the state insurance commissioners provide. You can have a tough state and an easier state.
And then there's the price of politics. Alan Sager teaches health policy at Boston University. He says Anthem Blue Cross of California ignored the political climate when it announced plans recently to raise rates by up to 39%.
Making outrageous 39% premium increases when the political spotlight is on health insurance is remarkably stupid.
Anger over the California rate hikes breathed new life into President Obama's proposed health care overhaul. The plan the president released today would allow the federal government to force Anthem Blue Cross to roll back its rates. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
So insurance companies aren't wild about the feds regulating health care premiums. Drug companies don't like the president's plan for a $10 billion fee on brand-name drugs. Nothing surprising there, except for the fact that health insurers and pharmaceutical companies were early supporters of the administration's health reform plans. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has more now on how things have changed.
At the beginning of the healthcare debate, insurance companies, pharmaceuticals, doctors, and hospitals signed on to reforms. But the president of the trade group America's Health Insurance Plans, Karen Ignani, says things changed last summer.
It's all politics. It began in July with a shift from a discussion of health reform to insurance reform, presumably because the polling suggested that was the right route, but it's certainly not going to get the country to where it needs to go.
She says the country needs across-the-board reductions in health care costs from everyone. Ron Pollack with Families USA, a consumer health advocate, says the entire industry should recognize they'll benefit from reform.
Each of the providers of care will get a very significant improvement in terms of their own narrow interest if health reform passes, because they will have much greater volume of services as new people gain coverage and others are protected from losing coverage.
All companies like to be on a winning team, says health policy professor Leighton Koo at George Washington University.
So they figured that they might as well be in favor of the legislation and try to steer it somewhat in a direction that was helpful to them, or at least less hurtful.
Now, Professor Koo says some industries aren't so sure that health reform is inevitable, and that's why they're backing away. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Toyota acknowledged today that it's been subpoenaed by a federal grand jury and by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Documents released over the weekend show Toyota bragging about the money it saved when the floor mat problem it's having was classified as an equipment recall. Sure, it looks like Toyota might have been trying to downplay this whole mess, but Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains that to a lot of people, it just sounds like business as usual.
When a vehicle has a problem, it's up to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, to decide how serious it is. NHTSA classifies some defects as annoying, but not life-threatening, and some as real safety issues that warrant a recall. Kenneth Ragsdale is an engineering professor at the Missouri University of Science and Technology. He says NHTSA's decisions are the result of negotiations. The agency takes its concerns to the manufacturer and gives it a chance to respond.
The companies will try to negotiate with data with NHTSA to say, this is the level that's appropriate. They want it to be confined at the lower levels, a mechanical issue that doesn't have a serious safety implication.
He says sometimes there's no obvious conclusion, and the agency just has to use the data it has to make a decision. No company wants to issue a safety recall because it's expensive and it looks bad. So companies work hard to show that their vehicle's problems don't merit a recall. Joan Claybrook ran NHTSA under the Carter administration. She says that doesn't mean these companies are covering up something.
If a company comes in and says, you're really off the mark here, this only affects XYZ vehicles, for example, or these model years, or this is not the real problem, that can be very legitimate.
But she says it is up to the agency to figure out whether the company is telling the truth. NHTSA has been widely criticized for its role in the Toyota mess. David Strickland, the agency's head, is scheduled to testify at tomorrow's hearing on Capitol Hill. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Toyota shares gave up about 0.5% in New York today. The major indices did just a hair better. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Forget the Greek debt crisis that was all the rage 2 weeks ago. The United Kingdom is having public financing problems, too, and the Brits are looking around for any spending cuts they can. One tempting target is the special government payments keeping British senior citizens warm in the chilly European winter. But it seems some of the folks getting at least $380 a year or more to keep warm may not be all that cold at all. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The fuel payment is aimed at helping older Brits survive the country's long, hard winters. As a government advertising campaign points out, anyone over the age of 60 can apply for the payment.
It's dangerous for you to be cold in the winter, and this is the time when you really need to seek help. A lot of people don't realise...
People get the benefit regardless of their means or where they live, and that includes some of the Brits who've retired to warmer climes.
If you thought owning a place in the sun was out of your reach, then think again.
Egged on by TV shows like this one, hundreds of thousands of Brits have made their homes abroad, in Mediterranean countries like Spain, Portugal, Italy. 64,000 of them are still receiving the winter heating subsidy from Britain. Mark Wallace of the Taxpayers Alliance is not amused.
I, like most other people who have come across this story, was amazed that anybody ever thought it was appropriate to give these kind of payments to people who've had the good fortune to retire to the sun.
British taxpayers have forked out more than $150 million in winter fuel payments to these sun-tanned expats. This has got to stop, says Wallace, but the Mediterranean retirees have their defenders.
If they have, in fact, paid their taxes into the British system, then I think it's fair that they do carry on receiving this payment.
Leslie Snowden of the National Energy Action Group says the retirees deserve and need the winter heating subsidy.
Countries such as Germany, France, some parts of Spain, Portugal, even Italy, do have winters very similar to Britain, and their energy costs are quite comparable.
But a chill wind is blowing through Britain's public accounts. The deficit is widening fast. The Brits are shivering at the thought of all that debt. For the sun-seeking pensioners, the outlook is cloudy. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Almost 10 years ago, writer and sometime radio producer Jeff Biggers went along with his mother on a family trip to the coal mining hollow in southern Illinois, where she'd grown up.
Go slow, Doug. This is Dallas's house right here. Then ours was up on the hill.
This was Opera's house.
And, look at that.
What she was looking at, Jeff Biggers says, wasn't a house at all anymore, but a crater blasted away by strip mining. Jeff's book about what mining did to the miners, to their families, and to the land is called Reckoning at Eagle Creek.
You know, what I didn't realize, Kai, when we went up to this strip mine site, that it wasn't just our family that had been strip mined, but it's the history of the region that had been strip mined. And for someone who never really considered coal a part of my life, it set me off on this 10-year journey to really understand sort of the staggering human and environmental cost of coal that the rest of the nation really has paid for. You know, part of the great mythology is that coal is cheap and coal is clean.
Remind us real briefly, Jeff, what clean coal is or is supposed to be, actually.
Today we use clean coal to refer to carbon capture and storage, when we somehow are going to catch these emissions, these carbon dioxide emissions that come out of our coal fire plants that provide 40% of the carbon emissions today in the nation, and somehow put them back underground.
You mentioned cost, but Jeff, you know, for the average person on the street who uses coal-powered electricity, I mean, coal is just cheap.
Coal is cheap if you just talk about kilowatts, but now we have to talk about the external cost of coal. You know, the National Academy of Scientists just this year released an incredible study that showed us the external health care and environmental cost of coal were at least $62 billion extra dollars. If you look at the Black Lung Program, Kai, you know, where three coal miners still died daily from black lung disease, think about it, in 2010, we have to pay billions of dollars for this program because the coal companies defaulted on it.
Obviously, this is a heartfelt topic for you. I have to ask you, though, how realistic you think your fight is. As long as we can have cheap coal to power our electrical plants and don't have to see the damage, how far are you going to get?
You know, our expression now, Kai, is that we all live in the coal fields because we all live within an hour or 2 hours of a coal fire plant that is spewing carbon dioxide emissions. And as we've known from the research of climate destabilization and climate change, we're reaching a tipping point here. I believe the only way we can move forward is to commit to a coal-free future.
What about the industry itself, though, Jeff? I mean, down in the hollows in Illinois, where you're from, I'd bet there are people there who'd say, yeah, come on in, bring that mining stuff because we need the jobs. This is a region of the country that's historically depressed, now even more so.
Right, and I'm glad you bring up the issue of jobs because it's really one of the great mythology that somehow the coal industry has provided jobs. You know, the coal industry is heavily mechanized, and over 65% of our coal comes from strip mines like Mountaintop Removal in West Virginia and Appalachian states, where you literally don't need coal miners anymore. They use massive explosives, ammonium nitrate fuel oil explosives, and then heavy equipment operators like bulldozers. So for one job that we're using in the coal mine has ultimately taken away two or three other jobs that we used to have.
Okay, let me ask you this, though. The statistics are that coal accounts for something like 44-ish% of our electrical production. If we don't use coal,
and specifically clean coal, what do we use?
There are so many studies that show that we don't have to have one silver bullet to replace coal, that there's a smorgasbord of alternatives. We have solar, we have geothermal, we have offshore wind. There are so many different options, it's not funny. And the first way, of course, is to literally just reduce our consumption.
Isn't it a little bit like the price of oil, though, in that when the price of oil is low, there's no incentive for searching for these alternative means? And the price of coal, at least on the market, as the everyday consumer is concerned, is still fairly low. So there's no incentive for the search for alternatives.
And that is why we have to factor in the external cost of coal as part of the equation. Coal is the new tobacco of today. It is that dirty, and is that something that we truly have to move beyond.
You still have family down in Eagle Creek, Joe?
Eagle Creek ultimately doesn't exist any longer. You know, one of the oldest historic communities in America has been completely erased from the American experience.
The book by Jeff Biggers is called Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Coming up, credit card companies court a new kind of customer.
I wasn't carrying a balance, so I wasn't making any money for them. I just sort of thought that they, you know, didn't care about people like me.
Oh, now they do. But first, let's do the numbers. The stock market struggled into the green ever so briefly today, but by the close, the Dow had slipped 18 points, nearly 0.2%, finished at 10,383, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ shaved off a point, almost 0.1%, wrapped up at 2,242. The S&P 500 also slipped a single point, 0.1%, came to rest at 1,108. Bank of America stock rose 2% today, that after a federal judge approved a $100 million settlement over allegedly misleading statements that B of A made to investors when it bought Merrill Lynch. The Federal Reserve officials' reassuring words on interest rates helped lift other financial stocks. Wells Fargo galloped ahead by 2.3% today. J.P. Morgan Chase rose 2%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information is at massmutual.com. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee discusses policies for job creation and economic growth. And the Institute of Medicine holds a meeting on the long-term health effects of exposure to burn pits in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hundreds of banks have been closed by the government the past couple of years. One Washington Mutual branch office in Dallas, Texas, though, never even made it to open. It's standing empty and being demolished this week. But this past weekend, before the bulldozers, two local art curators, Christina Rees and Thomas Fulner, put together a show of financially themed pieces. About 650 people showed up to check it out.
I was here last night for the opening, and it was a turnout like you just don't expect to see, or I haven't seen in a long time for anything.
There's so many buildings that are abandoned in city landscapes, so it's part of a larger
landscape. It doesn't do a whole lot for the idea of security. You know, that's what the bank is supposed to stand for, you know. So obviously that's subverted.
That was Dee Nichols, Kate Holliday, and David Dibble in Dallas this past weekend. Christina Rees joins me now to talk about the project. Christina, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What is the story behind this building? Supposed to be a bank, but that never happened.
Washington Mutual was leasing the land from a friend of ours, Leland Burke. They built the building. It was completely finished. The ATM machines were in, the furniture, the stanchions, everything. It was ready to go. The government seized WaMu. J.P. Morgan Chase, who took on WaMu, didn't want the building. So the building, I think, was just defaulted back to Leland Burke.
Tell me about the art. Was it always going to be a financial art thing that you guys had in mind?
We chose artists who we knew could really deal with that space in an interesting way, in a sophisticated way. We didn't want, you know, we didn't want things to be so literal. There were pieces that were more about cycles or ownership or responsibility, and some of them were a little bit more aggressive, but we just wanted them to have fun.
We sent some folks out this weekend to get sound from this exhibition. We're going to play it for you, and I want you to walk us through it. It is, as everybody will hear, water dripping through into a bucket. So drip, 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 the financial cycle, I don't know. Help me out with that one.
The show is called Modern Ruin, and one of the artists, Cam Shep, he put an irrigation system throughout the ceiling. There were 7 buckets set throughout the bank itself, some even back into sort of back bathroom areas, and he basically created a leaky roof. He made it a ruin before it actually accrued that kind of damage.
Not the ceiling leaking, it's just the banking system leaking, right?
Well, you know, you could read it that way.
That's right.
If you so choose. Yeah, absolutely.
Obviously, the tangible stuff is preserved, but what about something like a leaky irrigation system? Is it just, is it gone out there into the great art diaspora along with this building that's about to be demolished?
Yeah, you know, I think most of the artists are hoping that the artwork will just go with the building. Some of the artwork is so site-specific and installed in the building using the building's materials that when the building is torn down, the art goes with it.
Do you have a favorite?
There was a really intense room that was a collaboration between two artists, Jeff Zilm and Kevin Todora, and we called it the Angry Room. Somebody had come in prior to us and ripped the ATM machines out. And so if you walked into the lobby of the building, you could look through these big holes into this little room. I'm not saying that there was a lot of hostility toward the policies that led to recession, but in this room there was. But there was a huge portrait of Ben Bernanke that had been completely desecrated.
Oh, man.
And there was a video of fire, and there was a big durian fruit that had been sliced open and that was stinking up the entire room. It's really anxious-making and kind of crazy.
Now that you've dipped your toe into financial art, so to speak, any thoughts on it for the future for you?
I'm a curator at Texas Christian University, and that's my full-time gig. But, you know, one thing that's, I think, great about a recession, one of the only things that's great about a recession, is it causes artists to become more resourceful, start to find new and interesting and creative ways to get their work out there. And there's a really good feeling in the air right now in this area, and you know, some great work has come out of recessionary times. The New York in the 1970s, that's still some of my favorite work that's ever been made. So, you know, maybe there is a silver lining here somewhere.
Christina Rees, the exhibition this weekend in an abandoned Washington Mutual branch office in Dallas, Texas, was called Modern Ruin. We've got some pictures of it up on our website. Christina, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
This may be just another Monday for most of us. For credit card companies, it's a whole different day, not necessarily in a good way for them either. The overhaul legislation that Congress passed last spring went into effect this morning. It puts restrictions on a lot of the interest rate increases and fees that consumers paid, billions of dollars worth. That's on top of perhaps $150 billion that credit card companies have lost since the recession started, when consumers stopped using their cards as much or just walked away from the balances due. So the credit card industry is catering to a new kind of user now, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Back in the credit card boom years, you know, a couple of years ago, careless was king. Credit card companies built their business on customers who spent more than they had and didn't pay on time. Robert Manning is the author of Credit Card Nation.
In the bubble era, the best customer was somebody who could never repay their loans. They would just pay interest and fees forever.
Credit card companies took in more than $200 billion a year from those interest payments and fees. But now many of the customers who paid all of those penalties are in financial trouble and defaulting on their debts. So card companies are turning their attention to the customers they used to ignore, like Washington, D.C. doctor Elad Sharon.
I wasn't carrying a balance, so I wasn't making any money for them. I just sort of thought that they, you know, didn't care about people like me.
They didn't, but now they do. Because people like Sharon, who use their cards responsibly, are about the only customers card companies have left. But they're not going to bring in much in the way of interest payments and late fees, so card companies are finding other ways to make money off of them, says Ron Shevlin, a banking products analyst for the Aite Group.
The best customer for the credit card issuers are going to be people who pay the balances off every month but make a lot of use of the card on a regular basis. That's going to drive a lot of interchange revenue for the issuers.
Interchange fees are what merchants pay card companies every time you use your card. They added up to nearly $50 billion last year. To push that number higher, card companies are looking for ways to convince the credit savvy to swipe with abandon. So Shevlin says card companies will give more to get more.
People who make heavy use of the credit cards are doing that to run up their rewards points. And so you see firms going back now and strengthening and bolstering the quality of their rewards programs. But as they compete for new business, they're going to look at the rewards programs as the new battlefield.
Elad Sharon gets cash back every time he uses his card. So he pulls it out of his wallet for just about everything.
It's my American Express Blue Cash card. I've used it so much that the blue box that they have is actually kind of fading.
American Express and Chase's new Sapphire card are tempting consumers to wear out their cards by offering cash back, flexible rewards that don't expire, and extra service.
New Chase Sapphire. You call, we answer. No waiting. Just press right.
Premier Rewards Gold Card from American Express. The only charge card that earns triple points on airfare.
To appeal to more frugal consumers, Discover and Capital One are touting the practicality of their rewards.
Discover card customers are getting 5% cash back bonus at grocery stores.
Card companies have also started attaching rewards to debit cards, like airline miles, cash back, and flat screen TVs. Card companies will also be rolling out hybrid cards that can tap all of your accounts and work as a credit card. By rewarding credit card customers now, banks are banking on being rewarded in the future, says Credit Card Nation's Robert Manning.
Banks are hoping that when consumer confidence turns around, they'll be coming around for a car loan, buy a new house.
In other words, credit cards are the financial industry's new gateway for things like mortgage loans and investment products. Cards will help lock in the loyalty of responsible spenders like Elad Sharon, who pays nothing for his cashback Amex and gets a few hundred dollars back every year.
Actually, I always kind of felt guilty about the way that I used my credit card. I felt like I was getting all these benefits and, you know, poor American Express was basically paying for my easy lifestyle.
Don't worry. They'll think of some way you can make it up to them. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note on the way out today. Even as American athletes continue to do so well in Vancouver, the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee says there probably is not going to be a U.S. bid to host the 2020 Games. Scott Blackman said he doesn't see an American city spending the $80 million that Chicago spent in a losing bid for 2016. No word on that whether that $80 million counts reimbursing the White House for the president's failed lobbying trip to Copenhagen, if you remember that one. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow down 18 points, almost 0.2%. The NASDAQ off a point, nearly 0.1%. The S&P 500 also dropped a point, 0.1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, educating doctors about the drugs that they prescribe.
You know, you don't have time as a doctor to verify what everybody's telling you. You just kind of smile and sign for the samples.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.